I'll begin on a parochial note. And, I'm curious, in a room which has plenty of folks of a certain age, I've got this affliction. I got a torn tendon, and it's known as mallet finger. Has anybody here heard of that, or even perhaps suffered through it?
Croquet mallet?
Well, it's spelled that way.
Yeah.
But there's no particular linkage between that pursuit and this injury.
Is it an injury?
Yeah.
Something that's genetic.
It's an injury, yeah. And I'd never heard of it before when I wondered.
It comes from giving people the fingers.
That's what I was wondering. Were you at some Democratic meetings or something?
I was not doing anything fun or interesting when I incurred the injury, I'm sorry to say. It's a pleasure to be back. It's a pleasure to be on the program in the company of such a distinguished panel of speakers, and really enjoy being here. I'm coming up on fall, if assuming continuity, and I'm back. It'll be the 10th anniversary of the first time I spoke here. We're looking ahead to the 2002 midterm elections.
Wow.
And such was the level of anxiety, we were trying to figure out, well, will the Republicans do reasonably well in these 2002 midterms? It ended up being one of our good cycles, but when I was speaking, we had anxiety about the possibility that Jeb Bush would be upset by Bill McBride, a name mostly lost to history. It shows how the storylines that the media tends to conjure up can unsettle us, even in a season when we're headed for good things. And I would say that this week has illustrated that also. The media has lately reflected a lot of the same bravado that you see from the Obama campaign, and a sense that Mitt Romney has damaged goods and Barack Obama has so many fundamentals. There's been a great deal of hype around this idea of the most hyperbolic formulation, the war on women. But it all collapsed, or seemed to, with this gaffe where Hillary Rosen seemed to derogate Ann Romney for being a stay-at-home mom. And to me, the lesson was we need to see through the bravado of the Obama campaign, and we need to recognize the artificiality of so many of the storylines that are generated by the media. The media will launch 100 storylines about why the Republicans are sure to fare poorly in the fall, and maybe discuss one of the reasons why the Democrats need to be concerned. It's very unbalanced, and we keep our heads best when we account for that and avoid letting it. And especially for those of us on campus, and I know not everybody in the room may necessarily identify when I use the first-person plural to describe Republicans and conservatives, but even if you are if you're on campus, whatever your political persuasion, it's all the more important to remember that half the country is conservative, and half the country may not resonate the same way as the Pioneer Valley to issues that are given great importance in the national media. And this war on women, quote unquote, is a classic example. The underlying policy question about whether religious institutions should be compelled to pay for contraception if that goes against their creed is one where the position that the Democrats and the president have adopted is less popular than the one that the Republicans have aligned themselves with. And because of a kind of artificial dynamic related to something unfortunate that Rush Limbaugh said, there was a lot of smoke that kind of obscured that for a while, but the fundamental policy point remains strong for the Republicans, and even more so it links to Obamacare and an enduring difficulty for the president. So, you know, with all that said, I guess by way of just saying, we all need to work on keeping our heads this year when the media is trying to dispirit us and confuse us. I know that the interest is highest in the presidential campaign. I take an interest in the congressional campaigns as well, and we'll say a word about that because we are trying to win the Senate this year. But I do want to take a little time to try and talk about the Electoral College and try and figure out as best we can from a fairly significant remove in time what the outlook in the Electoral College will be. I guess before I get into that, though, some general themes that are emerging, and I'll try to credit the analysts I draw ideas from, because it's one of the other things that is very important for us in staying grounded in the sometimes disorienting media climate of a presidential year when the media is very invested and biased, is finding the analysts who are reliable. And I think that one place you can go to find the analysts who are reliable, and I recommend for everybody, is the site realclearpolitics.com. Realclearpolitics.com is balanced in terms of left and right, but they find and push to the forefront the analysts who really are clear-eyed and incisive. So that's where, if you went to that one site, you would probably find most of the analysts who I think are really key. On the left, one who I think is very solid is William Galston. He's at the New Republic. He used to be with Al Gore in the Clinton administration. Now he's, I guess, at the University of Maryland. But he's pretty bearish from a Democrat vantage point on his party's prospects. And in a column this week, he pointed to factors that despite the bravado of the Obama campaign, he sees as critical differences between now and 2008. The Obama campaign, in general, wants to project a mood of, this is going to be a rerun of 2008. Just like in 2008, it wasn't clear we were going to win at the beginning, but then everything went our way and we roared to victory. This is going to be the same thing, so don't get your hopes up, Republicans. But Galston points out that this is going to be a referendum election and not a choice election. The Obama team wants to contest this, and they've sent out Joe Klein to make an argument in the column today. I haven't had the pleasure of subjecting myself to that argument today, but suffice it to say, Klein's in the minority of folks who think that it's going to be possible to avoid the dynamic of a referendum election, that is, an election where the question of whether you cast it as, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago, or does this incumbent deserve to be rehired or replaced, is at the forefront. That is a difference, and it is a difference that will redound clearly in ways that make it more difficult for the Obama campaign. Another difference is that Obama is going to lose some of his most effective themes. He's not going to be able to campaign on a promise of bipartisanship like he did last time. That promise is pretty well dissipated. And so he's deprived of that aspect of what worked for him, his winning recipe in 2008. He's not going to be able to campaign as a optimist. And optimism and hope being so critical to what he did in 2008, you start to see that many of the structural supports of his appeal are removed, and there's less and less left. It was Andrew Sullivan who said, "Begin with that face," and I guess he'll still have that. He'll still have that face. The question is how much people really still want to see that face. Something more mundane, but critical, is the support that Obama had from critical sectors in the business community. It's a taken for granted thing that a Democrat will have strenuous support from the labor sector, but in 2008, Obama had enthusiastic and massive support from Wall Street and from Silicon Valley. He may have some. He will have some from those segments, but he'll have less. And Romney has a great entree into particularly the Wall Street sector. Another factor is the youth vote. Obama benefited from not just a crushing margin among young voters, 2-1, but a surge in their numbers that was reflected in an increased portion of the total electorate that voters under 30 constituted. Obama may still get a 2-1 win among the under 30 voters, but there'll be a smaller proportion of the total, and that will make it harder for him to recreate what he achieved in 2008. Another thematic point is the ability to be all things to all people. And Democrats historically, in a country where liberals and the base that they provide for the Democrat Party are a smaller segment of the electorate than the conservatives, who are the base of the Republican Party, have always had a much more acute dilemma in balancing the demands of swing voters with the demands of the base. So in 2004, President Bush was able to lose a lot of the swing vote, lose moderates, lose maybe just come out ahead barely among independents, but win because of the number of conservatives was enough when supplemented with the minority of moderates to eke out a majority. For Obama, the choice between themes that appeal to swing voters and themes that appeal to Democrat base voters is going to be a much more painful dilemma. When Obama does what he's been doing for the past few months and rallies the Democrat base, he's forfeiting the opportunity to appeal to swing voters, and it's reflected in the polls where his support is very soft, his approval is low, and his approval on the issues that swing voters care about is low. If he shifts focus and tries to engage swing voters more directly, he's going to be struggling with his base and trying to maintain that turnout level that he so needs. So that's going to be difficult in a way that was not for him in 2008. And finally, he's at the mercy of events, whether it's the job creation numbers, which after the last jobs report don't look so hot in terms of what we can expect in the next few months, events in the Middle East, and the U.S. Supreme Court ruling on his signature legislation. He's no longer able to ride the waves of events like he did in 2008 when he seized a solid high ground position in the midst of the financial crisis. Now events are the object, I guess, of events rather than in a position to take command when things like unexpectedly occur. So all these things suggest that he's going to struggle, and deprived of the themes that worked so well for him in 2008, he has to villainize Mitt Romney. Jay Kost, who we had at our most one of our Washington meetings recently, says that the formula will be something like J.P. Morgan plus Barry Goldwater equals Mitt Romney. And the J.P. Morgan is the caricature of the robber baron. The Barry Goldwater would have to be updated to incorporate their efforts to demonize on social issues, but it would be the right-wing, scary right-wing extremist. Jay Kost points out that Romney, while somewhat constrained by the dynamics of the Republican primary that he's been broiled in for the past few months, will no longer be so constrained, and he can command significant resources to counter that impression and portray the real Romney, the person who has done many concrete things that are admirable. And certainly, when you talk about what he's achieved outside of government versus what Barack Obama achieved outside of government before coming to the national stage, it's a pretty striking contrast in terms of the absence of anything concrete in the one instance and very impressive concrete accomplishments in the other. Romney's not as impressive in terms of, I would say, what he's accomplished in government. His signature achievement in the Romney health care plan here in Massachusetts is something that cuts against him as much as it cuts in his favor. The trick for him will be to talk about the principle of working across the aisle and passing something with bipartisan support without, I suppose, inviting voters to dwell too closely on what he actually passed in that respect. I think Cost's point is accurate to the extent that he will not be a passive victim of letting his record be defined by his adversary. But the more fundamental problem, also pointed out by Jay Cost, is that when Obama comes up and talks about Romney as robber baron or Romney as right-wing maniac, he's avoiding the subjects that voters really want the election to be about. And that puts him in a position where he can be put on defense. And the defensiveness comes through in incidents like the other day when he admitted that his Buffett rule was a gimmick. Well, he didn't admit it was a gimmick. He admitted that it wouldn't solve the deficit problem, and then he had to retrench. Today he's out there in his radio address saying that the Buffett rule will help with growth, which is audacious and ridiculous. And I think you see some flop sweat on some of these issues where even some of their friendly journalists are skeptical that the Buffett rule is... This happened in the fall with the tax on corporate jets. He was talking about the corporate jets so much that the liberal media was screaming for mercy. Don't make us walk out on a tightrope, so to speak, with such a thin wire underneath us. It's not tenable. So I think there's defensiveness because these gimmicks are just not going to hold up over the long haul. And for Romney, the challenge is to bring it to substance, make it about a very clear focus on the 4 years that have come before and the failure of Obama in so many ways, all the legislation that he's accomplished, from the stimulus to the health care plan being unpopular, and the health care plan possibly being tossed out anyway. And then talk about, you couple that with the very powerful weapon that Obama gave him of talking about what he would do in a second term and what an unknown quantity that second term agenda really is. Obama's going to try to portray Romney as a little bit of a man of mystery too, saying that he's concealed some of his real views and there's some running room for him with that, but he hasn't given the opposition as powerful a weapon as Obama did when he made that remark to the Russian prime minister about, wait till my second term when I'll have more flexibility. That's a very damaging statement that Obama made, and I think it's one that Romney will ride all the way to November. So that's the thematics, and then you get to the real fun, which is looking at the Electoral College. I like to play little games on a yellow pad and put the states in different categories. And then the AP came out with their current read on the Electoral College, and I could see where I was in sync with them and where I differed from them. My assessment was pretty much in sync with theirs. I identified about 9 key states, and they agreed with me on most of them: Colorado, Nevada, Ohio, Florida, New Hampshire, Virginia. They also put New Mexico on the list. I wasn't sure about New Mexico. I put Michigan and Pennsylvania on the list of key toss-ups. They see those states as leaning towards Obama right now. And they put North Carolina on the list of true toss-ups. And I'm skeptical that's a true toss-up. I think that the fundamentals are pretty solidly for Romney there, and that if Romney hasn't taken North Carolina out of play by October, it's not going well for him. That's a state that is the Democrat incumbent governor there isn't even running for re-election. She didn't even want to chance it. Republicans are going to pick up that governorship in all likelihood. So, but for the most part, I think there's a lot of states and a lot of electoral votes that you can pretty much assign with a high degree of confidence. There's 186 electoral votes that Obama has in his pocket, and the states are all the ones that come up in the discussions of fiscal irresponsibility, the big ones, New York, California, and Illinois provide a bunch of those electoral votes, Maryland, my own state. So that's 186 sure thing electoral votes for Obama, 156 sure thing electoral votes for Romney in states that are much smaller for the most part, except for Texas, but also Kentucky, Tennessee, Georgia is a big one. Then you get down to those ones in the middle. Arizona, Missouri, and Indiana probably going to go for Romney and give him another 32 electoral votes, and that takes you to 192 for Romney. Now, the AP gives Obama the edge in Michigan, as I said, in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, but says those are not sure things, and that's 56 electoral votes. They get Obama up above 240 by giving him those states, and then they identify that group in the middle that I talked about with 104. But what you see is that it's very winnable for Romney if he's able to, first of all, lock in Arizona, Missouri, and Indiana. As I said, I think that's pretty much a sure thing. And then make a strong bid for the states I mentioned at the outset, and then the four in the heartland. If the AP said if the recall goes for Scott Walker, Wisconsin suddenly looks a lot better for Mitt Romney. The Michigan, the key X factor or the key unknown is how damaging is it for Romney that he opposed the auto bailout. That's giving the Obama people a lot of confidence. It's unknown, though, how problematic it is statewide. New Mexico is the one state where the Hispanic factor is important, and Romney may feel, if he's avid to get those five electoral votes, that he has to revise the tough position he took on immigration in the primary. If he does, he'll be taking a risk with his standing in the heartland industrial states. He doesn't have a tremendous amount of the benefit of the doubt to give away, on my read, in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan. Iowa's in the mix here, too, although I don't think it figured into the AP's mix. I think that's a state where Romney runs a risk if he tries to get too cute on immigration. That swing vote in the Midwest is a swing vote that he has had in mind in formulating his tough immigration position. And while there will be voices in the Republican establishment encouraging him to try to placate the traditional pro-amnesty constituencies in the Hispanic vote, and there'll always be support for that in the business community, I think that there's peril in that. And those five electoral votes seem to me to be the only truly the ones truly at stake. I don't think Florida is going to hinge on whether Romney tacks to the quote-unquote center on immigration. And I think that Romney can make a strong play for Florida simply on the economic issues. And you're talking about a state that's struggling with high unemployment, where Obama has significant problems with the Hispanic community, can be put on the spot. Does his flexibility mean that he'll open up to the Castros in the second term? I don't see Florida as a reason for Romney to make that play on immigration. Nevada's a state with a lot of Mormons, and I think that may be an underappreciated factor. I feel actually pretty good the more I think about Nevada as another state with six electoral votes that I think Romney can make a very strong play for. Because of the high unemployment, the housing market crisis being so acute there. So you look at those key swing states, and I think Romney has a lot of them that he can make a strong. Clearly New Hampshire, a state where he owns a house and is seen as their kind of Republican and has not been part of the Republican column in the last two elections. It would be good to get that back, and I think he has a strong chance there. And in Virginia, which is the emergent swing state, the swing state that wasn't a swing state until recently, he will look at Bob McDonnell for VP. And in fact, McDonnell possibly would have the inside track if Ed Gillespie is running the process, because Gillespie is very close to McDonnell. But I don't think he would need to go that route to get those electoral votes locked in. I think that it's still a state that that leans conservative, and that Obama won Virginia by virtue of his ability to outspend McCain 7-1 there in 2008. That made a big difference, and he won't have that advantage against Romney. So when I look at swing states, I see a lot of upside for Romney, and I see a real struggle for Obama. And his own team, when they talk to friendly journalists about their electoral college scenarios, they're all essentially inside straight scenarios where Obama goes all in to get just enough electoral votes to put him over. Now, that is what George Bush did in 2004, and he pulled it off. It's not to say it's a fruitless endeavor, just to say that I'm not sure that that Obama is in as fundamentally a strong a position as Bush was, and there's a lot of reason to think that he's in a much weaker position. But all that said, we can talk more about I think I want to shift to the discussion part, but we can talk more about Romney, and he certainly is an enigma to a larger extent than many of us might wish at this stage in the process, and there's ample reason to be concerned about what he'll mean over the long term. But I think if you look at the top lines with Romney, there's more to be encouraged about than discouraged about, because in a situation where the incumbent is seen as not having answers to the fundamental challenges of jobs, growth, energy, and national debt, Romney has the profile of a solutions provider, a guy who solved problems in every environment he's been in the past, and pragmatic. A lot of us maybe like a little more ideology in the alloy, but when we're talking about swing voters, the more comfortable fit might be somebody who has the pragmatic approach or the pragmatic image, and so I think that image is the structure. What Romney needs to do now and in the coming months is fill it in with substance, and prevent obviously Obama from doing that for him. If he can do that, I think there's an excellent chance that he would be able to make a very strong approach to the electorate. All that said, I know I've missed some factors, and I haven't gotten to the Senate. I won't go to the discussion. Just say that the Senate looks very good. There are a lot of opportunities for Republicans in a lot of places, and probably just going on the races where Republicans have the clear edge, and balancing it against the one race here where the Democrats might be favored. Republicans have an excellent chance to take the chamber. Democrats have done some things right. Republicans have done a lot of things right in recruiting, and right now I would say that the conservative estimate is that Republicans get the chamber. They could take it by a lot. Democrats would basically have to run the table and do some things that nobody can easily see them doing to keep the chamber. But if they could keep it, their loss to the point where they'd only gone down to 49 seats, they'd be able to say that they had averted the worst, and that may be a realistic aim for them. So let me bring.
What are the good the states that really look good to you right before you vote
for the Senate?
Yeah.
Well, you talk about the states where Republicans are ahead right now. You've got North Dakota, Kent Conrad retiring. Democrats seem to be on the path to forfeit, but then recruited Heidi Heitkamp, who had been elected state attorney general, and having somebody who'd won a statewide office puts them miles ahead of where they thought they were going to be. Certainly a recruitment success for the Democrats. She raised $733,000 in her first quarter in the race, which is a good number for North Dakota. But all that said, the presidential dynamic is is rough for the Democrats. We probably pick up North Dakota with Rick Berg, who's the freshman congressman. And then you know, we have to hold an open House seat. But North Dakota looks good in the presidential year. Nebraska, Democrats avoided a forfeit by getting Bob Kerry to jump in at the last minute. Kerry is off to a strong start in fundraising. In these states, the fundraising is the one thing that the Democrats can control. And it's where they get most of their good headlines. They're not getting them in the polls. The polls show Bob Kerry trailing badly. And what he's counting on is that he's a better candidate than any of the Republicans who are mostly untested in a high-profile national race. But the, when I say he's behind in the polls, I mean he's behind by more than 10 points in the polls. And so any hopes of that nature are pretty much private hopes of Bob Kerry's at this point, not realistic hopes for Democrats nationwide. We probably pick up Nebraska. That's two of the three seats we need to flip the Senate. We are ahead in Missouri, even though our field there is regarded as weak and little known. Money will come in to help us beat Claire McCaskill. We have a clear edge in that state. Montana, John Tester is a freshman who was probably perfect for 2006, running as a populist farmer, pro-gun but anti-war. Not really perfect for 2012. The bloom is off the rose. Danny Rayburg, coming from the House, is a little politician-y, perhaps. Not the fresh face that would excite Tea Party folks, but very, very capable of giving people a place to go when they decide that Tester's too far to the left for them. We probably, on current trends, pick up Montana. Virginia is very close because Democrats got Tim Kaine, who's a former governor and DNC chairman who can raise a lot of money. George Allen is somewhat dinged up by virtue of the circumstances that he lost the seat 6 years ago, a case where somebody didn't realize how much they wanted to be a senator until they had lost the job, and now he's decided he wants it again, so that's good. And he probably has the edge, but most people think that the state will go the same way in the presidential and the Senate, and Kaine's best hope is that Obama can pull the state out, although he'll have a ton of his own money, and it's possible that there could be a split where the Republican wins it at the presidential, but Kaine hangs on somehow. That's a long shot, kind of a scenario, though. Probably that goes the way the presidential goes. We have targets that are higher. On our side, defending Scott Brown is critical and difficult, but possible. It's just really hard for a Republican to win a federal race here in a presidential year. Well, proved this in '96 when Kerry was able to win on Clinton's coattails. But what we're counting on, I think, in part, is that Obama's coattails are not quite as impressive as Clinton's '96 coattails. And Romney is, of course, from here. So, no one's writing Scott Brown off. We know it's going to be hard. Nevada, Democrats have recruited well, and it's the one state where Harry Reid can perhaps have the most direct effect on whether he stays as majority leader, so he'll be working every lever. But I think that Dean Heller, appointed to hold the seat after John Ensign retired, wins election in his own right. And we keep Nevada. Democrats are hopeful that Lugar would be defeated for renomination in Indiana by someone who's easier to beat. But the person who is running against Lugar is a statewide elected official who led the ticket in 2010 and has to be regarded as the favorite, even if he is the nominee. And in Arizona, where Kyle has retired, Democrats like Richard Carmona, the former Bush Surgeon General, But Jeff Flake is probably favored in a presidential year where, if you ask me, Obama doesn't have such bright prospects for carrying Arizona. So a lot of opportunity. We're even trying to win Hawaii with Linda Lingle, a Jewish Republican, moderate woman. She's the only person who actually wants to be considered an Olympia Snow Republican. But to win in Hawaii, that's what you have to do. probably tough in a presidential year. But we have other prospects, like in Ohio with Josh Mandel, another Jewish Republican, and his prospects against Sherrod Brown are pretty strong. Florida with probably Connie Mack against Bill Nelson. So anyone who wants to get involved in a kind of a donor capacity will have tremendous opportunities across the board. We're looking to pick up seats in New Mexico and Wisconsin, where the Democrats are probably going to run candidates who are too far to the left. And we have solid moderate candidates, moderate conservatives, though, not the ones who at least would willingly be associated with Olympia Snow, Tommy Thompson in Wisconsin, and Heather Wilson in New Mexico. So tremendous opportunities across the board for Republicans to really improve the Senate. I could go on and on.
Okay, good. Take some questions.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, if I were Obama, I would ask Mitt Romney in a debate. You're a pragmatic man, and you likely want to work across the aisle. I know that you believe in global warming. How are you going to work, if you were elected president, how are you going to work with the Democrats to enact global warming legislation, which we both favor?
That's clearly one of those areas where Romney has...
Well, I know that, but how do you think he might answer that?
How would Romney answer that? I think he has to be mindful of his heartland fundamentals and not say anything that would undercut him in terms of Michigan, Ohio. His instinct would perhaps be to split the difference and say that, well, there's a more moderate way to do it. But I think he needs to turn it into a critique of the way Obama has handled it. So, well, rather than just... I'll tell you right off the bat, I'm not going to do it the way you did it, with this ridiculous cap-and-trade law that...
Well, how are you going to do it, then? We both believe in global warming. You've got to be serious about global warming. We believe in global warming.
I think you go back to the message that's worked for Republicans in the past that says any approach that's going to really address the problem has to... have buy-in from all the countries. If China and India are not in, I'm not going to put America on the hook for job losses when China and India haven't made the commitment. And we need a framework that pulls everybody in. He can finesse it with so many of these issues with Romney. It's just a question of does he have the conviction that his position is the right position. In some instances with Romney, there's that syndrome of in your heart in their heart they know they're wrong, and if he treats the conservative position that he's campaigned on like it was a guilty secret, then I think you're right that Obama can unsettle him with a strong approach like that. But the positions are all. I don't think he has to reinvent the wheel or be especially creative. I think he just needs to have the courage of the convictions that got him the nomination.
This one's maybe you just say he can handle another degree or two.
Jared?
Jared? Yeah. What's your take on the vice presidential possibilities for Governor Romney, both the ones that are frequently mentioned and can be brought up?
Well, Ann Coulter put John Kyle's name out there prominently, so I'm not blazing any kind of a esoteric trail when I promote my old boss. I think she made the case that he's someone who does very well in the ready to be president index. He's not very well known though, and he's not very exciting.
Solid, and
very conservative, and the more heralded, perhaps, choice along those same lines is Rob Portman. Rob Portman is newly elected senator from Ohio, but he's not a novice in the big time because he was the budget director and trade director. And you'll see people like Paul Begala say, oh, good, pick a Bush guy. I really hope you do that. But Portman will say, well, let Portman just won election in Ohio. as a Bush guy. So that's another instance of bravado. Portman is happy to contrast his record as a Bush administration official with what the Democrats have served up on jobs the past 4 years. I think Portman's incredibly solid choice, but he's not glamorous. I think that it's a mistake to choose with that first moment impact in mind. Like Bob Dole got great press in 1996 for a week when he picked Jack Kemp, but it was not a great choice for the long term because Kemp couldn't throw a punch, and they were up against he was up against a strong puncher in Al Gore, and he just wasn't up for the full kind of full-throated critique you need to take on incumbent. So it doesn't need to be somebody who really excites, but it's possible to counter and say, well, what about somebody who's substantively solid and excites? All right, now Marco Rubio. I don't think it's a mistake that Marco Rubio is regarded as a strong prospect. My personal taste is that I would like somebody a little more seasoned in the national arena, and that Marco Rubio has a great future, but it would be a little soon to put him, you know, right there, one step away from the presidency. And I think, I like Rubio a lot, and I think he would perhaps surprise in a debate with Biden, but I wouldn't approach the prospect with a tremendous amount of confidence. And Rubio is a great set piece speaker, but I'm not sure that I have the degree of confidence in his off the cuff, you know, his ability to be really solid off the cuff. Rob Portman's very disciplined and would stay on message. Bob McDonnell comes up. I think that Romney needs to be able to win Virginia without Bob McDonnell, and he should only pick a guy like that if he really thinks he adds value once he's on the job and as a future president. But he shouldn't pick him with electoral considerations in mind. Dark horses. People are dropping the name of Kelly Ayotte. I think that's she's a freshman senator from New Hampshire. I wouldn't say anything against her, just to say I think that the impetus for discussing her is largely an overreaction to the current anxiety about women and voters You don't pick someone from a small state like New Hampshire with the Electoral College in mind, although she probably would lock it down. And that's four electoral votes that could be important.
What about Steve Flom's former governor?
Tim Pawlenty?
Yeah.
I mean, the joke about Pawlenty is that Romney would pick him if he wanted to seem exciting by contrast. but the guilty admission that I have to make is I thought Pawlenty should be president. I was on board with the idea of him as our standard bearer, and I'd still make the case. I mean, he failed the market test, so there's no point in saying that as a Pawlenty partisan I was robbed. Just to say, he had the experience governing in a conservative fashion that I don't think Mitt Romney really has, and he certainly had the experience getting reelected in a state that's not a hardcore red state that Mitt Romney didn't have. The state is bluer in Romney's case, but he didn't stand for reelection, and that's something that was a limit on the upside of his ability to make the case that he'd be a strong national candidate. My concern about Pawlenty, though, is that he's too workmanlike, and that Romney would want somebody I'm going against my earlier point. You don't want to forfeit the pizzazz factor completely. It'd be one thing to say you shouldn't pick with pizzazz as a primary consideration, but you could come at that the other way. I'm thinking on my feet here. Tim Pawlenty does have the experience as a successful executive in a conservative fashion. Maybe that's something that should merit consideration. The problem may be as superficial as He's got the taint of a loser on him because of the way his presidential campaign went down.
Right.
And if you can't stand up to Michelle Bachmann, how are you going to stand up to Joe Biden?
How about Sandy?
No.
Well, she brings problems that are not widely appreciated related to how she, in contrast to Rob Portman, who has a great story to tell about how he did the job he had in the Bush administration as budget director, the story she tells as Secretary of State is not a great story. In many ways, she hatched the Obama policies, whether it's the idea of waiting for some kind of a diplomatic miracle with Iran and hoping that obviates the need for a more muscular response to the threat from there, or she did not impress on the Middle East front at all, and I know that in my segment of the Republican universe, there's not a lot of nostalgia, and there's a sense that she really did get a head start on the kind of feckless diplomacy that has characterized the Obama administration. So I think she's someone who comes on with a lot of pizzazz, but doesn't do too well as you contemplate the prospect at greater length.
Is she pro-choice too?
And she's pro-choice on abortion.
She's not going to be taken
away. Yeah. And she wants to run for senator from California. She's welcome at any time. Yeah, Doug.
Yeah, one point, one question. Just adding to your points that are changed this year advantageously is McCain last time promptly gave up on campaign donations and accepted the because of his background and fear of campaigns, he accepted the limits, which clearly I think Romney won't. So the money advantage that you alluded to in Virginia is not going to be the overwhelming Democratic positive this year, and because I think either, both of them are going to raise plenty of money.
It wasn't just Virginia either. Ohio, any state that really mattered at the end, any state that was on the bubble in the last few weeks, Obama had the ability to outspend McCain by a factor of 5, 6, or 7 to 1. So it goes to the whole dynamic of how desperate you have to be in the campaign, and it's going to be different. McCain had all kinds of problems. His association with campaign finance, but also the fact that he didn't count on Obama breaking the promise to accept the public money, so once Obama broke the promise, McCain couldn't turn around and raise the big bucks because he'd burned the bridges with the donor community, the business community. He was helpless. Romney has not burned those bridges, and he will be a potent fundraiser, and we have every reason to hope it'll be evenly matched.
Now my question gets to the demographics and the youth vote, because it strikes me what you have is you've had older residents of the U.S. have died, and then younger ones have come in. That would seem to favorable to Obama, unless those that have gotten a little older get more conservative. Is that what your sense of this is?
I think that the one factor I didn't mention is the Ryan plan and the Democrats' hopes that with the older voters that are still out there, Romney has to run up a big margin among older voters. So the Democrats have a lot of hopes that they can do the mother of all Medicare campaigns and say, given what we all know about our fiscal trajectory, this would probably be the last time they'd be able to go to the mattresses in terms of a Medicare. But they think they can still do it. And I think that's one of the big questions of this election. Is that a busted gambit, or does it still have one more good election in it for the Democrats? But assuming that it washes out somewhere in the middle and that Romney does have a solid advantage with older voters, the youth vote is probably going to return to a more traditional low turnout model. Every indication is that it's going to be very hard for Obama to excite young voters, and that there's it's hard to see how it would be different than any other election where Democrats' major problem with young voters is that there's just not enough of them. So I think that, yeah, the electorate may be getting younger, but where it's probably getting swelling is in the middle. And that's where it's really going to be won or lost, with swing voters in the middle of the age spectrum, as well as in the middle of the ideological spectrum. I think that you may have a shrinking senior cohort. You're almost certain to have a shrinking youth cohort. It just ends up underlining, in my rough assessment, how critical baby boomers and Generation X are, because I don't think at the age extremes you are likely to have as big an influence as in the past. I could be wrong. I haven't undertaken that's a hunch-based assessment.
What do you think is putting off the younger voters? Why do you think that enthusiasm won't be wanting will remind this stuff?
I think there was a sense, however vague, of a nexus between voting for this hope and change that they saw advertised and seeing positive results in the landscape of their lives, jobs, affordable housing. And because of the unemployment problem that's more severe in their cohort, there's too severe of a disconnect. Obama can't really paint that picture anymore because there's a reality picture that...
It's Bush's fault. Still Bush's fault.
That sounds like a recipe for keeping a high margin among the young voters who turn out, but having a smaller number of them turn out. So I guess I heard his former bodyguard or body not bodyguard personal aide Reggie Love came to campus, and
Obama's. Yeah.
He's on a campus tour to kind of rally student enthusiasm. But I think that's, this is part of the base. Coming to Amherst College is rallying the base. There will be at the most liberal colleges, there will be enthusiasm for Obama. But I think out in the non-college young vote and at the more moderate state universities, I don't think you get that same kind of rallying effect anymore. Yes.
Can I play devil's advocate?
I didn't get too enough of that from my first question.
Are you concerned at all that some of this, what Republicans call class warfare rhetoric, will actually stick? So we can't bail out the union stiffs in Michigan, but we can bail out the fat cat bankers. Right? And there's a lot of agitation about this, and some of it is, I think, it registers among ordinary people, it registers among middle of the roadish Republicans. There's something unseemly about the way the country looks. So is it, and especially once the fundraising numbers come in and where the money comes from and all the rest of it, I think the drumbeat may So what would be wrong? Mr. Romney will have to say something about tax reform anyhow. Right? All the verbal won't last. And so why doesn't he say something along the lines? And would it be a good idea to say something? Look, I agree. All this airplane stuff, that won't raise a lot of revenue. But the exemption is stupid. And by the way, in the world I live in, bonuses should be taxed like ordinary income. That I call carried interest or bonus. The only reason why that stuff isn't taxed is that Chuck Schumer sits on that as well and is in bed with his friends. Come on now. I think the signal value might be huge. I understand he may not want to say that right out of the box, but you think it might be a good idea somewhere along the lines of making some maneuver like that?
as we all know from watching presidential campaigns, you make certain some baggage may get thrown off the plane. The corporate jet loophole may get thrown off the plane. The carried interest loophole, I think, is tougher because of how much support Romney has reaped and still expects to reap from the hedge fund industry. But I think it has to be thought through on a pragmatic basis. In general, I think that the message is tax reform, and don't just go out and grab revenue from politically soft targets, but say we want a flatter code and we'll go after some of these loopholes that benefit the rich, but only in the context of a sensible, orderly process and not in a class warfare context. I think that's the better message. But exigent circumstances may dictate, and Romney's shown a little bit of a weakness for this kind of joining the lynch mob mentality already.
Yeah.
It's, by eliminating capital gains, holding capital gains above $200,000 out from his tax plan, which is most capital gains. He's shown a certain predilection in that regard. I'm not worried that he'll be too principled to consider these options, but I think he has to win a bigger message war with the Obama campaign. What you're describing when you talk about the Obama people going after him on the sources of his donations is a making the best of a bad situation. They're getting outraged. They might as well try and make Romney pay for where the money's coming from. That's attending to the fundamentals, but they'd rather have the money. They had it last time, and they were able to. It's better to have the money than to try and make a debit on the other guy's, ding up the other guy for getting it from that source. I think that is something Romney has to be concerned about, but I think he can't give away the store at the same time, or he'll just get pushed from one of these little junctures to another. And like I say, I'm not worried that he'll be too principled. I'm probably more worried about the contrary risk. Yes, sir.
Enough of these softball questions. let's talk about the largest questions of privilege. As everybody knows, one of the largest burdens on the economy and on national life and on the country's feeling of what is fair and not fair is the network of privileges written into legislation. For example, the ethanol mandate. Here you have a whole industry that exists only because Congress mandates, Congress, the law, mandates that certain things be bought that otherwise would not be bought. Ethanol for motor fuel, inefficient in every way, et cetera, et cetera. There are any number of things like that. Sugar, subsidies. The economy, the country is shot through with special deals. Now, the most economically rational thing and the thing that would increase the people's sense of fairness most would be to identify a whole bunch of these things which are in favor of which no rational argument can be made, only political arguments, and simply take them on that basis. I have no reason whatsoever to believe that Mitt Romney will do any such thing. Do you?
Well, I think that there's an opportunity there, and the question is not, again, is Mitt Romney such a rock-ribbed conservative that he's offended the way we are by these things? The question is Mitt Romney a canny enough politician that he'll see the political upside in going after at least some of them? And the element that I realized I didn't get to in your question was special deals and the sense that perhaps Obama can portray Romney as more inclined to protect special deals. And I think that Romney can, because what we know from Obama's struggles in public opinion is that he's more identified with the bailouts than he wishes he was, that he carries the taint of having supported special deals more than he thinks is fair. So at the outset, it's not a clear-cut thing that Romney has more of this taint on him. But if Romney wants to press the advantage and try and deepen Obama's problem and prevent his own, it seems to me that it would make sense to make a list of the special privileges you're going to go after and the donors that'll entail burning bridges with, and make another list of the ones you're going to leave alone and go after the targets that you deem appropriately soft and pass up the chance to go after the ones that you deem not worth the trouble. Ethanol's not what it was because the blender's tax credit expired and the tariffs on the foreign sugar-based ethanol from Brazil expired.
But
so
the mandate is there.
Wouldn't it make more sense for him to go after the most critical, is it the government picking winners and losers, investing money in Solyndra.
Same thing. It's the same thing.
But I think the people would understand the green.
They understand at the gas pump. They know that that ethanol is A, less efficient, B, more expensive.
Yeah.
I think he's smart enough to be aware that there's opportunity there. But it actually feeds back to your other question. When does the fight over green virtue become too daunting a consideration to take on the winning fight over privilege for green energy? I hope that Romney sees the upside in making Solyndra a household word. I don't think it is yet, except among people who watch Fox News and listen to talk radio. But
that's only $500 million.
But no, the whole clean energy.
It has to be the example of something
yeah,
bigger.
Yeah, I think that they're alert to these opportunities, but they have to be prepared to deal with the counterattack. Well, you don't care about our energy future. It seems like a winning issue because right now, swing voters share Republican skepticism about the efficacy of these green alternatives. And I think almost any of these issues. Sugar is a tougher one you mentioned because it gets to Florida, and a state that Romney can't afford to lose. Louisiana may be unlosable for the Republican, but these are things that you have to go on a kind of a Machiavellian case-by-case basis. And if I'm optimistic about one thing that I think Romney has proved, he's pretty Machiavellian in this. If he sees a political upside, he'll run for it. The people say he's timid, but he's gotten this far. I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic that he'll have the right combination of ruthlessness and alertness to Obama's actual vulnerabilities. And then when we come back in 6 months, we won't be shaking our heads and saying, "How do we get to this place?" But we'll be saying, "Steady as she goes."
Do
one more thing for me. I don't want to anticipate George, step on George's mark. So I want to ask you what would be the kind of style of the campaign he should be running. I think George will probably get to that. Here's an odd question. Why couldn't Romney tell Obama that I don't want a debate with the major media running it? We've seen what happens. Let's have just the two of us at this thing. We'll both make arguments in the old style. I think so. And if he doesn't go for that, fine. We don't have debates. And I don't have to get on the air showing how much I respect him and how a good person he is, but I differ with him. And he avoids that whole charade. What about doing that?
A lot will depend on the polls when those negotiations take place. and whether
if he thinks he needs it, Romney thinks he needs it.
Yeah, yeah. Who's negotiating from a position of strength, and who's negotiating from a position of really needing those debates? And if Obama's needing those debates, I hope
he
would drive a hard bargain and say, "I want Bret Baier," or "I want."
No, a timekeeper. We'll just go. We'll make your argument about what you think the central issue is. Let him
Romney
respond.
Romney will not opt for a situation that's that difficult to control. He will want.
It's easier to control the major media asking questions.
He would rather have a moderator he doesn't trust than have Obama be able to seize command. I tell you right now, I just don't think Romney would want to look at. There was that one debate where he lost control and kind of appealed to the moderator to rein Newt Gingrich in. This is not a guy who is prepared to. Yeah, Romney and spontaneity don't go well. He does not want a spontaneous, Obama would be much more formidable to the if you take away the moderator.
In debate.
Yeah,
you think Obama's more nimble?
Yes.
The
teleprompter thing is true to the extent that. Substantively, Obama says foolish things, but the close in combat of a debate is not so much about substance as it is about footwork. And I think that is not where Romney wants to test his mettle.
Vince, last word.
I think that's the heart of Romney's problem, is that he doesn't come across as someone who's comfortable in his own skin, someone who's genuine, whereas Obama clearly comes across as someone who is authentic, and maybe that he can read and pass a lie detector test, but he certainly comes across as somebody who believes what he said. And, I know that these should not be arbiters of political correctness, but Saturday Night Live, if you look last week at what they did on Romney, he said a different group to a different thing to a different group every time. And that's the problem, I think, with Romney. He comes across as someone who is not authentic.
Yeah, I think what you say is there's a lot to what you say. The good thing about the debate is it's the one moment when, more than any other, you are saying the same thing to everybody. And that what he has to say when he gets to that moment is, well, what he has to keep in mind when he gets to that moment, and what the approach of the campaign has to be, is you'll never out-hip the ultimate hip candidate. Obama's about as hip as you can get for a successful politician, and Romney's a square, a throwback. So hip versus square, you have to frame it as not who's a companion for a night out, but who's going to do the job. This is about a job. But the ability to operate in a spontaneous environment is not integrally related to the ability to do the job.
But one thing that can be said for him is that he does look as though he's in command of himself, and he looks steady. And sometimes if you're bumbling, you look genuine. So the fact that I'm not sick. Remember one night I did see him, and he was remarking that people think that Mormons live longer because we don't drink coffee and don't have alcohol. He says, it's not that we live longer, it's just that it feels that way. And, I think there are things about him, he could throw in, and he said, I'm trying to get to all those 57 states the president talked about, I think there are all kinds of little. I mean, we had that great moment with Ronald Reagan. I will not hold my rival's youth and inexperience against him. That was planned, and that was a surefire thing to play against. It's within the state of the art to do that. There are zingers you could give him.
Obama's better at that.
Reagan could do all that stuff anyway, even without Clinton, too.
Reagan probably was the hippest candidate until Obama.
I paid for this microphone.
He had a degree of confidence that, you know, business leaders stage things so that they can be successful. You don't get to be a successful business leader by being able to just master any situation you're in. You get to be a successful business leader by staging it so that when you're in a situation, you've set it up that you can win. And that's what he has to think about with these debates. But spontaneity is not his friend.
Okay. Well, thanks again, though. That's great.